one Charlie Brainerd, whom Kate had known from Hartford and Fenwick for close to 70 years. "Charlie and I remember when all this was our playground," Kate said affectionately. "We're still pretty lucky to be living here," he said. "It's still fun." "Charlie," she said with a toss of the head, "we're pretty lucky to be living anywhere." Knowing a good exit line when she heard one, she wrapped her cane on the steering wheel of the golf cart, and we were off again to see the inner lighthouse, which required our walking across other people's property. Whether the owners were home or not did not matter. Fenwick was still her playground, and she always seemed to draw strength just watching the flow of the Connecticut River. She told me that her family's original house in Fenwick was completely destroyed by the hurricane of 1938, and that she had built the present house larger and stronger. Heading back toward the Hepburn house, and then beyond, she reminded me that the river connected Fenwick to Hartford in the north. I told her I was no stranger to the Connecticut River, as I had spent a great deal of time along its banks even farther north in Windsor, Vermont, which had been Max Perkins's summer and ancestral home. She seemed a little surprised, not that I knew her river, but that it extended beyond her territory. "Republican," she said as we drove around. "All very Republican." She was speaking of the Hartford insurance families, her neighbors and summer friends. "We were always left of center," Kate said of her family, thinking how the Hepburn brood must have appeared to the rest of the upper middle class in Hartford. "I'm sure they considered us extremely eccentric, a tribe of wild Indians." And with good reason. Dr. Thomas Norval Hepburn and his wife, Catherine Houghton Hepburn, were unlike any of their peers, and they prided themselves on the differences. While both were active members of their community, they and their 6 children had always stood slightly apart. Tom Hepburn came from 2 Virginia families, the Hepburns and the Powells, both of which had suffered economically during the Civil War. His father was a poor Episcopalian minister, his mother a proper lady, who believed women did not get a fair deal in life and that they should obtain proper educations. "He was very good-looking," Kate said of her father, "and he adored women." He had been a great athlete at Randolph-Macon College and studied medicine at Johns Hopkins. Catherine Kit Hepburn was almost 2 years his senior, the daughter of Caroline Garlinghouse and Alfred Augustus Houghton, pronounced Houghton, not Houghton. She was in many ways the woman Tom's mother might have become had she been born a generation later. Alfred Houghton grew up in the shadow of his dynamic brother Amory, pronounced Amory with a short A, who built the Corning Glass Company. Alfred suffered from depression, and one day after visiting his brother without explanation, he put a bullet through his brain, leaving a young wife and 3 daughters. Not long after that, Caroline Houghton, Kit's mother, learned that she had stomach cancer and that her days were numbered. She knew her wealthy in-laws would see that her girls would never starve, but she did not want them to be subjected to their very reactionary ways. "Very Republican," said Kate. Their only life insurance policy, Caroline Houghton hammered into her children's head, would be a college education. She moved her family to Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, where there was a new college with a wonderful reputation for Kit and a preparatory school next door for the younger girls. When Caroline Garlinghouse Houghton died at 34, her 3 children were farmed out to one relative then another. Although rich Uncle Amory oversaw their finances, Kit stood up to his conservatism and insisted on his paying for her college education, something he considered a worthless enterprise for women. Catherine Houghton graduated from Bryn Mawr College, and her 2 sisters followed. One of the sisters, Edith, went on to Johns Hopkins to study medicine, where she met Tom Hepburn. They became friends and fencing partners. Then he met her older sister, who quickly fell for him and found a teaching job in Baltimore just to be near him. Without much money between them, they soon married, confident of opportunities for a bright young doctor and his college-educated wife. Over several offers from hospitals in New York, they chose the small, prosperous city of Hartford and moved into a house across the street from the Hartford Hospital. They promptly had 2 children, a boy named for him and a girl, born May 12, 1907, named for her, Kate. "Venereal disease was being discussed by my parents as long as I can remember," Kate told me that day. In fact, I later learned, it had been a topic of conversation among Houghton and Hepburns before that. Edith Houghton never became a doctor, ultimately marrying a classmate, Donald Hooker, instead. But she did travel to Germany to study the hottest medical topic of the day, and she came home sufficiently informed and inflamed to incite several around her. Venereal disease was, of course, directly related to prostitution, which had all sorts of socio-political ramifications, including the white slave trade and teenage pregnancy. Thus, venereal disease was directly linked to issues relating to the oppression of women, a connection that was not lost on either Dr. or Mrs. Hepburn. Kate would never forget the regard her mother held for her mother, how the young Caroline Garlinghouse Houghton had died so young, full of expectations for her girls, envisioning something more than traditional homemaking, pleasing a husband and raising children. "And there was Mother," Kate said of those early years of marriage, "thrilled to be Mrs. Hepburn. But she was also a woman with a really good mind and an advanced degree. She was a wonderful speaker and an attractive woman, and she felt she should do more with her life. She became restless, a real rebel without a cause." One day, Dr. Hepburn noticed in the newspapers that Mrs. Emmeline Pankhurst, the English suffragist leader, was speaking in town that night. He insisted they attend, and an activist was born. Mrs. Hepburn became the head of the Connecticut Woman's Suffrage Association, and later a friend and colleague of birth control advocate Margaret Sanger. She worked at the grassroots level, trotting young Kate out in parades and having her pass out pamphlets, and took on all opponents up to and including local newspaper editors and the mayor. "But Mother's secret," Kate would tell me repeatedly, and this was true of the most effective early feminists, "was in remaining extremely feminine. She dressed beautifully, she tended to her husband, she showed off her well-groomed children, and then, while she was pouring the mayor a second cup of tea, she would discuss with great intelligence some great injustice being heaped upon his female constituents, and then she'd smile and say, 'More sugar.'" Dr. Hepburn supported his wife in all her campaigns. As regularly as possible, he came home from work at tea time so that he could spend time with his children, discussing adult matters with them, playing with them, challenging them to support unpopular causes. More than once, the Hepburns had rocks thrown through their windows. 4 and then 6 years after Kate was born, the Hepburns had 2 more children, both boys, named Richard and Robert. 5 and 7 years after that came 2 girls, Marion and Margaret, known as Peg. Each pair was born in a different house in Hartford, each house a little bigger than the last. There, Jimmy, pairing off with her older brother Tom, used to race the trolley cars down Farmington Avenue on her bicycle. She said there was not a single tree in town that she could not climb, not even an especially dangerous one on Hawthorne Street. She delighted in telling of the neighbor who called Kate's mother and said, "Mrs. Hepburn, Kathy is on top of the hemlock tree." And how Mrs. Hepburn replied, "I know, Mrs. Parrott, please don't frighten her, she might fall out." Kate and I rode in the golf cart to the western side of Fenwick, beyond the tennis courts to a few gridded streets with pleasant-looking houses. "You must meet Marion," she said. "Hey!" Kate yelled as we walked unannounced into a handsome place, then undergoing renovation. Marion appeared, obviously a Hepburn. While very pretty, she was less glamorous than Kate, her face rounder and her features less pronounced. Then came her handsome, white-haired husband, Ellsworth Grant, whom Kate had warned me was very rich. They were the parents of the actress Catherine Houghton, who had played Kate's daughter in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Kate introduced me, saying, "This is Scott Berg, my biographer." "Whoa," I said, shaking hands with our hosts, who were somewhat taken aback themselves, knowing there had been a lifelong interdiction against giving writers personal access to the family. "Let's not get ahead of ourselves." "Well," said Kate, "I mean he's learning everything there is to learn about me, because now he's writing a piece about me for a magazine. Think of him as the man from Spy," a reference to the magazine for which the Jimmy Stewart character worked in the Philadelphia story. "Now this is Marion and Ellsworth Grant," she said. "They've been married forever, they've been in love with each other forever, and they've been sleeping with each other since they were 15. "Catty," said Marion. "Kate," said I, and Ellsworth stood silent, grinning. "Well, it's true," said Kate, "and you should be proud of it, because you're still a damn good-looking couple. Now, what are you doing to this place?" We trooped through the house, upstairs to the master bedroom, where Kate decided the bed was terribly positioned. "Now look," she said, "you've absolutely got to move this bed. I mean, it's crazy. You've got one of the most beautiful views in the world, and you're not even waking up to it. Move it over here, and you'll wake up to glorious sunrises, looking out onto the water. It's insane otherwise. Well, said Ellsworth, we like it here. But what's the point, Kate said, now exasperated. I mean, what's the point of living in one of the most beautiful spots in the world, with one of the most beautiful views right out your window, and you're refusing to look at it? You're hopeless, the both of you. I mean, just hopeless. It's a waste. This whole house is utterly wasted on the likes of you two. And we were off. Back at Kate's house, we went into the kitchen to scare up lunch. Phyllis was already at work preparing chicken salad. Don't forget to slice the grapes, Kate told her, obviously for the thousandth time. Vertically, not horizontally, she added, turning to me to explain that they'd tasted different if they were cut across their equators. At the far end of the kitchen, between the second refrigerator, the cabinets, and a stove filled with boiling and steaming pots of all sizes, their lids clacking, hurtled a big man, tall and stocky, in a red sweatsuit and wearing a rooster cap complete with coxcomb. Kate introduced me to her brother Dick. He offered a huge ham-like hand. Welcome, he said, holding a big spoon to my mouth. Now taste this. It was turkey soup, very hot, filled with vegetables. Now what would be good in that, he asked, as he made his way to the cabinet in search of spices. He returned to the stove with cayenne pepper, then he removed a macaroni and cheese casserole from the oven and stirred a saucepan full of candied grapefruit rinds. Now try one of these, he said, handing me one of the cooled candies. Kate was hungry, so we retreated to her side of the kitchen, where Phyllis was finishing the trays of chicken salad and green salad and toast and milk and zucchini soup. Each of us picked up a tray, though Kate paused at the counter to grab a dark chocolate turtle out of a 2-pound box before entering the dining room. After cleaning our plates, Kate asked Phyllis to see if any of the pots on Dick's stove contained hot fudge. One did, and we made huge sundaes. Now we can rest, Kate said. Just read the papers, or take a nap, or no, better that you see the town, and then we can come back and swim before dinner. Although her young driver from New York was there at the house, she suggested that we let him rest. So I took the two of us across the causeway in the white town car she leased from Hertz. That's the telegraph pole I drove into. Nearly killed Phyllis. Nearly killed me, too. Then turned left into the village of Old Saybrook. We stopped first at Walt's, a small grocery which Kate claimed had the best meat anywhere. She picked up steaks for dinner and a slab of unsliced bacon, and she grabbed a bag of bagel chips which she proceeded to consume as we walked through the market. By the time we reached the checkout stand, she had to tell the checker who weighed what remained in her bag of chips to double it. She signed for the groceries, then she took me through Patrick's Country Store, a charming shop with a lot of plaid woolen goods. She couldn't find anything she wanted, but she insisted I meet the proprietor. We made a final stop at James Gallery and Soda Fountain to pick up a few items, some newspapers, and so long as we were there, didn't I want an ice cream cone? I felt I'd already eaten enough for 2 days, but she insisted that James had the best ice cream cones anywhere. So she ordered maple walnut and a honey cone, and I went with chocolate and a plain cone. You can't order a plain cone, she said. They are so boring, it's like eating cardboard. They always taste stale. Well, this one is rather good, I insisted. Crisp, crunchy, and it doesn't fight the flavor of the ice cream the way your honey cone does. She simply shook her head as though she could not comprehend anything so outrageous. Get me out of here, she said, muttering. I never heard of anyone eating a plain cone. We returned to the house, and though it was getting cloudy and cold, Kate was ready for a swim. I joined her and found my tolerance for the cold water had increased in just 1 day. Or maybe it was being in the water together and not being willing to get out until she had. After a few minutes, we both headed for the outdoor shower. By the time we met downstairs again, it was starting to rain. Kate suggested I start a fire while she rustled up a game of Parcheesi. You do know how to play Parcheesi, don't you? She said. Oh, sure, I said, remembering Parcheesi from my childhood. You throw some dice and you move some green plastic pieces toward home. Well, you couldn't be worse than Phyllis, said Kate with a competitive edge in her voice that I had not heard before. So she'll play with Dick and you'll be my teammate. Dick, without his rooster hat, revealing a completely shaved head, entered the living room with a tray of mocha-flavored candy he had just cooked up. Overcooked, actually, so these thin squares that were meant to be chewed had become hard candies of sugar, chocolate, and very strong coffee. Everybody grabbed one while we set up the game board and chose our colors. "I have to be blue," insisted Kate. It became apparent after my first couple of throws of the dice that the game was not exactly the one I remembered, and that I had stepped onto a no-nonsense playing field. Kate looked at me with utter disgust, now stuck with me as her partner. Then I made the mistake of saying, "How hard can it be to pick up? I mean, it's sort of like chutes and ladders. 7-year-olds play this." "Well, clearly you don't have the brains of a 7-year-old," she asserted, suggesting that I was missing all the subtleties of this ancient Hindu game. As she took to moving my green men strategically around the board, Dick leaned over and slapped her hand. "You can't do that," Dick shrieked. "He has to move his own men. It's simply not fair otherwise." "But my partner is a complete idiot," she countered. "He doesn't have a clue what he's doing, and it's simply not fair for me to be penalized like this." Dick held his ground. "You chose him," he insisted. "You could have chosen Phyllis, but you took a chance on somebody new." "But I didn't know he was a complete idiot." We were all on our second or third candies by now, and the caffeine was kicking in. The tempo of the game had discernibly picked up, as had our tempers. I was truly getting the hang of the game's subtleties, such as they were, but after one unfortunate roll of the dice on my part, Kate stood up and said, "I give up. This is hopeless. I mean, he's positively hopeless." Dick insisted she sit down, that she had to play this game to the bitter end, which I kept praying would come soon. I like to think the slight tremble in my hands was the result of the candy, but now the tables began to turn, and after one of Kate's moves, Dick offered, "That was a great mistake on your part." For the next several minutes, they argued how Kate should have made her move. On Phyllis's next turn, Kate criticized her. On mine, my opponent, Dick, took to offering me advice with which Kate disagreed. "Now look," I said, "you've all put me in a terrible spot. On one hand, I feel I should listen to my partner, but on the other, Dick appears to be the best player and is on the verge of winning the game."
"Dick is not the best player," said Kate. "I've been beating him at Parcheesi all his life."
I followed my partner's strategy.
"Well, you're not going to beat him today," he said, making what everybody else had to concede was a brilliant throw of the dice. And let's remember, we're throwing dice here, which took advantage of my vulnerable position.
On Kate's next roll, Dick started in again, pointing out the errors of his older sister's plays. Meantime, Phyllis slowly and silently kept rolling dice and moving her little red markers until at last she threw her hands in the air and shouted, "I won! I won!" And sure enough, she and Dick had.
"I protest this game," Kate said with great authority, "on account of my having to play with a complete idiot."
"I resent being called an idiot," I said, "just because I didn't win this idiotic game. It's mostly luck anyway." At this, Dick took umbrage, claiming that it's actually a game requiring great intelligence and a sense of strategy, which he suggested Kate was too impulsive ever to master.
"Oh, you're all a bunch of idiots, real idiots," Kate said, putting the game away. "But I won! I won!" said little old Phyllis with great glee. "Yes, dear, you won," said Kate. "Now why don't you do something important, like get our dinner going?"
I announced that I was going upstairs for a little peace and quiet.
"Yes," Kate suggested, "you meditate on how you lost us that game."
During dinner, warm beet soup and plates heaped high with vegetables, baked potatoes, steaks, and broiled tomatoes.
"You must always have the wet of the tomato," Kate explained, "with the dry of the beef."
We talked about my current work, how I was attempting to paint a giant mural of Hollywood from its beginnings through the life of Samuel Goldwyn. Kate loved the idea, insisting that he was the most colorful and compelling of all the movie moguls.
"Of all those pirates, and they were all pirates," Kate asserted, "I think he was the only one with a sense of humor."
I told her about the play I had recently seen, K2, and its conclusion of the two mountain climbers being left to die. Kate insisted the playwright had made a terrible mistake, dramatically and morally. The injured man, who could not go on and who was only jeopardizing the life of the second man, she said matter-of-factly, should have thrown himself off the edge of the mountain.
"In offering his life, he would have saved a life. As it is," she said, "he is responsible for 2 deaths. That would have made for a much better play, really satisfying."
While Phyllis was off doing the dishes, Kate got to reminiscing about her family. That, she said, was the great advantage she'd had in her life and her career, what gave her a leg up. "Life is tough," she said. but one could have no greater support system than a family, people who knew all your weaknesses and loved you anyway. Her parents were obviously great examples of courage, common sense, and nonconformity. Also, I realized, narcissism. I never heard Kate speak a single word that did not honor her mother or father. Often she would say how lucky she was to grow up in so vital and stimulating an environment. And yet, in that conversation and many thereafter, I often detected annoyance in her voice and traces of ill will between the lines. There was a discernible resentment toward her father's bluster, a trait that bordered on bullying. All Hepburns were encouraged to exercise their rights of free will, but there never seemed to be a way to win his approval. Simply following meant you were weak. Defiance meant disrespect, both of which were frowned upon. Kate's love and respect for her mother was frayed with frustration as well. While Kit Houghton Hepburn was a genuine feminist pioneer, largely at her husband's instigation, Kate came to develop a filial impatience that her mother didn't blaze trails farther into the frontier. She appreciated the strides Kit had made for herself and other women, but she suggested to me more than once that had her mother stood up to her husband, she might have become a national figure like Margaret Sanger. But Dr. Hepburn was not about to let her abandon him and their children. So there was a catch-22. Kate always felt she benefited enormously from the strong family structure provided by the presence of two parents, and yet she always harbored some resentment toward her father for imposing his will, for standing in his wife's way. At an early age, she became determined not to let men tell her what she could or could not do. Kate's siblings were as important to her as her parents, providing compassion and companionship in the world she had created for herself, one from which most people would be shut out. While her brothers and sisters obviously delighted in her extraordinary success and her exciting presence, she knew they all had paid a certain price. Each of the Hepburn siblings developed large personalities as well in reaction to their dynamic parents as much as to Kate. She had become an international celebrity by the time they were teenagers, and so her two sisters sometimes seemed more like her own children. Marion, she felt, was the most intellectual of the lot, passionate about history and active in local historical societies. But Kate often remarked that she tended to be very social, perhaps in reaction to being ostracized because of her parents' extreme views, a tendency she didn't really understand. Marion, she said, always wanted to belong. Peg, who had graduated from Bennington College, proved to be the most opinionated of the clan, strong and articulate. She lived a hard physical life, independent, a divorcee running a cow farm upstate. The Hepburn boys were equally disparate from one another. Bob, the most passive of the children, found happiness in order. He became a Harvard-educated doctor and was mild, thoughtful, and highly congenial. Dick, on the other hand, next in line after Kate, was voluble and theatrical with a booming voice. Kate believed he suffered most from her success, for Dick was highly intelligent and artistic, a Harvard graduate himself who long yearned for a life in the theater. A fine musician, an amusing raconteur, and a skillful playwright with wicked powers of observation, he could never escape being identified as Katharine Hepburn's brother. He wore his resentment like a badge. Without his ever quite making a name for himself in the world, Kate made him her responsibility, allowing him to become a kind of ward of the castle. By the time I had played my first game of Parcheesi at Fenwick, Dick's first marriage had dissolved and his four children had grown, leaving him to move into the west wing of Kate's house. In some ways, he was a case of arrested development, a big kid. But he was extremely knowledgeable, well-read, and wise about people, so much so, Kate said, that he ultimately opted not to compete. Kate took full responsibility for his predicament and became his sole support. In the past, he had sometimes provoked her to rage, but by the time of my first visit, I realized that he could only irritate her. "What can I do?" Kate would say about him over the years. "He's my brother." And so they forged their own version of domestic tranquility, sharing the house in Fenwick, though sometimes going entire weekends without seeing each other, as they maintained separate sides of the same kitchen. All of Kate's siblings had children, and she spoke lovingly of her nieces and nephews. She was always happy to see them, and just as happy, she said, to see them go. Her closest and most complicated relationship was with the actress Katharine Houghton, who called her Aunt Cat, and who, between career moves, often lived upstairs on the fourth floor in Turtle Bay. That night, as rain pelted against the windows at Fenwick, I asked Miss Hepburn if she regretted not having children of her own.
I would have been a terrible mother, she said point blank, because I'm basically a very selfish human being. Not that that has stopped most people from going off and having children.
She proceeded to illustrate her main point.
Let's say I have a little child, she explained, and it's 7 o'clock at night and baby Johnny or baby Janie suddenly comes down with a 103-degree fever. And I've got 1,200 people waiting to see me that night at the St. James Theatre. Now, some of those people, I'm thinking, have waited months for their tickets, and some of them have scraped together money they can't really afford and arranged babysitters so they can have their special night that year. And now little Johnny or little Janie is in pain and screaming and yelling, and there's no question what I have to do. I would walk into that baby's room and take a pillow and smother that adorable child. I'm terrifying, Kate said after a dramatic pause, but I'm smart enough to know I'm terrifying, and that's why I didn't have children.
Without provocation, Kate went on to talk about the defining moment of her own childhood, a story that all but determined a life of coolness and compassion. In 1920, at Easter time, Mrs. Hepburn sent Kate, almost 14, and the older brother she adored, Tom, to New York City for a holiday. They stayed in a charming brick house in Greenwich Village with one of Kit's friends from Bryn Mawr, an attorney named Mary Toll. For several days they went sightseeing with Auntie, taking in a stage production of A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, based, of course, on the work by Hartford's foremost citizen, Mark Twain. The selection of that play resonated especially for Tom, then 15 and a half, who attended the Kingswood School in West Hartford, the campus of which had been one of Twain's former homes. Tom was growing up to be tall and handsome, but he'd been a diffident boy, in many ways not his father's son. He lacked the swagger. As a young boy, he developed facial tics and later suffered from St. Vitus's dance, an ailment then attributed to stress. Dr. Hepburn expressed no great concern, noting simply that his father had walked through life with a shaking head. Mrs. Hepburn came to believe that perhaps the pressures of so dominant a father, one who seldom parceled out praise, might have been difficult for Tom. In time, however, Tom outgrew the condition, becoming confident at school, popular, athletic, and a very good student. As many of the neighboring kids still considered the Hepburns outsiders, a colony unto themselves, Kate felt unusually close to her older brother. Jimmy even wore his clothes. On the Saturday of their spring break in New York, the children went to bed around 10, after Tom had entertained Kate and his godmother playing banjo for them. The next morning he did not come down from his attic bedroom for breakfast. At 9, Kate went to inquire. When he did not answer her calls, she went into the unfinished studio, only to find him next to the bed, hanging from some torn sheeting that had been tied to a rafter. Kate ripped down the sheet and felt her brother's skin. It was cold. The 13-year-old was in too much shock to remember precisely what happened next. In her memory, she ran to a doctor across the street shouting that her brother was dead. A woman at the doctor's house said that if he was dead, he didn't really need a doctor. In time, adults wandered onto the scene. Kate's parents came down to New York. She sailed with them on a ferry to New Jersey, where they had her brother's body cremated. During the crossing, she saw for the first time her mother cry. She never saw as much from her father. For days, people grasped at explanations. Kate recalled that there had been a hanging incident in A Connecticut Yankee that had intrigued Tom, and Dr. Hepburn recalled that Tom had been fascinated with a story the doctor had told of being able to fake a hanging by tightening up one's neck. But the more she thought about the theories, the less likely they seemed. The truth was, this family had already been plagued with 3 suicides. And even considering Tom's eventual success at school, Kate suggested, he was never really charged up quite like the rest of us. I had heard that maybe a girl had rejected him. Who knows, maybe a boy. Whatever it was, he simply could not cope. Whatever it was, nobody in the family talked about the incident for years. Whether it was accidental or intentional, over lost love or newfound feelings, young Tom Hepburn was dead, and not all the deliberating in the world could bring him back. Nor, I was to see, would he ever be completely laid to rest. His ashes were buried in the Cedar Hill Cemetery in Hartford, but there were no family visits. Tom would haunt Kate for the rest of her life, and she argued one scenario, then another, in search of an explanation. While she simply could not understand why he would take his own life, she was willing to accept that he had.
There's just so much about people, she concluded, that we can ever really know.
Dr. and Mrs. Hepburn refused to allow gloom to permeate their lives. Previous generations on both sides of the family had treated disappointments and depression, indeed mental illness, simply by forcing themselves above it or swiftly succumbing. Moaning and complaining had never played in their house, and now it was simply not tolerated. All the Hepburns were encouraged to move on with their lives with even greater intensity. Over and over, I would see that this incident affected Kate more than she realized, keeping her from ever delving into the past or even dwelling in the present. Like the rest of her family, she listened to the song of life, the refrain of which was always, "Get on with it." The tragedy hit Kate hard. She would be loath to say it hit her the hardest, because that would suggest complaining. A sensitive teenager going through her awkward years, a strong, freckle-faced tomboy becoming an unusual-looking young woman, she entered her own private crucible. In a town where the Hepburns had been considered odd, the suicide, veiled in mystery, stigmatized them even further. Kate dealt with her renewed feelings of isolation by role-playing, becoming stronger, prouder, even haughtier. She learned to mask her feelings, to create one persona that would greet the world, while she hid another that she would fight to keep private. She would cloak her loneliness and insecurities with a personality that could entrance. She was becoming an actress. For the second night in a row, Kate and I stayed up past midnight. Before retiring, we put the fire to bed, extinguished the lights, and checked on the kitchen, where Dick often left a gas burner lit or something cooking in the oven. We found that his lady friend, Virginia Harrington, had baked a gigantic chocolate layer cake. Kate insisted I take a slice, from which she scraped off a mouthful of icing with her index finger. Walking upstairs, I thought about all the personal stories Kate had imparted in the last few days, and the urgency with which she shared them. It occurred to me that most of the people in the professional stories she told me were either dead or dying, and while she had scores of good acquaintances and millions of fans, she had few intimate friends outside her family with whom she could share things. I also believed that because of her injured foot, Kate was slowing down for the first time in her life, and all the time and energy that she formerly had to run around was being directed inward, forcing her to remember and to ruminate.
"You and I see the world the same way," she said as we were turning down my bed. And then she looked me soberly in the eye and said, "You are me." Just like that. The way Emily Bronte's Cathy said, "I am Heathcliff."
I took it as a compliment, thinking she meant we both approached life with optimism, or at least that we laughed at the same things. With a kiss on my cheek and a night-night, she was gone. By the next morning, we had developed our routine. She had already enjoyed her swim, newspaper, and breakfast before I joined her. A pink grapefruit prepared by the lady of the house herself always sat on my tray in the kitchen, and a discussion of the news awaited upstairs. Then Phyllis would magically appear with a clipboard and pad to make notes on our day's agenda and menus. This particular Sunday was drizzly, with heavy storms forecast well into the night. I asked Kate if she had slept all right, in light of the tenderness of our conversation the night before. She said she always slept well, though we would have to stop staying up that late. Far from embarrassed by our conversation, Kate was eager to complete it. After her brother's death, she said, she had stopped attending the Oxford School, the sister school of Kingswood, and was tutored at home. She succeeded in being admitted to Bryn Mawr College, though during her first year she stuck mostly to herself. She occasionally ate with the other young women, but one day as she approached a table, she heard one of her schoolmates say, "Self-conscious beauty." Kate easily accepted the self-conscious part, but puzzled over the rest. She never returned to the dining room again, eating her meals in town. Over the next 3 years, Katie Hepburn gradually came out of her shell, appearing in a succession of plays on campus. She had no reservations about taking the male leads as she blossomed into a strong, striking-looking woman. Making little effort to find intramural friends, she cultivated a social life for herself off campus. While most of the students cloistered themselves within Bryn Mawr's neo-Gothic walls, Kate made friends with several men on the outside. The young woman who seemed to stride through town living by her own rules had become like catnip. At a dance, she met a graduate art student named Bob McKnight and went so far as to pose nude for him, the figurines on the mantelpiece in New York. Both were smitten, but too consumed with their respective budding artistic aspirations for much more of a relationship. Senior year, Kate befriended a townie named Jack Clark, whose house literally shared a lawn with the campus.
He wasn't some parlor snake, Kate told me, though he was one of the many young men along Philadelphia's main line who had enough money not to have to worry about what she called the mechanics of life.
Men of ease, with apartments in New York City and limited ambition. Clark shared another property, a small country farmhouse on 20 acres, with his best friend, a similarly well-fixed young man, named Ludlow Ogden Smith. Kate often went out to the farm, sometimes allowing a few friends from Bryn Mawr to tag along. Unchaperoned, the young ladies flirted with a little danger. One afternoon, when Kate was alone with the two men, she went so far as to pose for some nude photographs. She was proud of them at the time, but wished she knew whatever happened to the set of blow-ups they sent her.
"Long after I'm dead and gone," she said, "I'm afraid somebody's going to find them and say, 'Good God, that's Katharine Hepburn!'"
At a luncheon that same year at the home of the Dean of Bryn Mawr, Kate met a well-known poet, H. Phelps Putnam. Although a married man, Putnam's reputation as a rake was superseding his reputation as a writer.
"Having such a man on the Bryn Mawr campus was like having a fox in the hen house," Kate later admitted, "and I found him utterly fascinating."
She used to climb down the vine outside her second-story tower room to take midnight strolls with him. But Kate maintained her virtue,
"and I think I drove him wild," she said, laughing.
Barely 20, she became the inspiration of his poem, The Daughters of the Sun. She was the living anarchy of love. She was the unexplained, the end of love. She was my nourishment, my sister and my child, my lust, my liberty, my discipline, and she laid fair, awkward hands upon my head. She was discourteous as life and death, and kindly as a dry white wine is kind on a blousy summer day. For beyond space, she was my quality. She was the very mask of my desire. By the time Kate graduated from Bryn Mawr College in June 1928, she had a pack of men pursuing her. But by then, this model of the living anarchy of love had set her sights on a career. She depended on the kindness of suitors. Jack Clark had some show business connections, including a man named Edwin Knopf, who ran a theater company in Baltimore. Clark wrote him on Kate's behalf, and upon graduation she appeared at the theater and was hired on the spot, evidently on looks and personality alone. She got a small part in the Tsarina with Mary Boland, a well-known actress of the day, and everything came easily to her. She learned lines and blocking quickly, and Miss Boland took her under her wing, teaching her how to apply makeup and how to make an entrance, a rapid walk and a slow discovery of the audience. After her second play, Knopf decided to include Kate in a production that he was taking to New York, a work called The Big Pond. The leading man, Kenneth McKenna, recognized her talent but also her shortcomings. He strongly supported her inclusion, but urged her to invest whatever money she made in voice lessons. He even wrote a letter of introduction to the best vocal teacher in show business, one Frances Robinson Duff, who could boast that she coached two of Broadway's foremost actresses, Ina Clare and Ruth Chatterton. Duff took Kate on as her pupil, forcing her to perform all sorts of Henry Higgins-like exercises, blowing out candles, speaking with marbles in her mouth, reciting phrases that emphasized certain sounds and syllables. To Hepburn's final days, it pained her to hear people pronounce the word horrible as though it were horrible. She would interject with the Robinson Duff corrective exercise, "Ha, ha, horrible!" Similarly, chocolate was always chocolate, never chocolate. She never mastered breath control from the diaphragm, which she claimed caused her voice's premature rasp. Neither of Kate's parents thought much about her career choice. Her father thought acting was just plain silly, a foolish way to spend a life, and her mother had practically no interest in the theater at all. But Kit Hepburn saw it as a way for her daughter to avoid the kitchen and nursery, to advance herself, to lead a life of her own. Despite his misgivings, so did Dr. Hepburn. He grubstaked her. Kate moved to New York only to discover what a small town it was.
"Manhattan was really like an enchanted island," she said, "cut off from the rest of the world except for a few bridges."
The theater world was even smaller, with everyone connected to everyone else. Her friend, Phelpy Putnam, as she called him, was apartment sitting for his friend Russell Davenport, an editor at Time and Fortune. And Kate simply moved in with him. Suddenly, she was showing up at fashionable parties, meeting the likes of Robert Benchley and the rest of the Algonquin set, and turning heads. Her virtue remained safe with Putnam. Kate later reported, as it seemed good enough for him just to be known to be living with a beautiful young actress. After a while, in fact, it was she who became miffed that Putnam did not even make a pass at her. Only later did she learn that her father had permitted this highly progressive living arrangement only after having privately confronted the poet. "Now listen, Putt," he'd said to the sophisticated older man, "my daughter is like a young bull about to charge, and she will do everything she can to seduce you. But if you lay a hand on her, I'll shoot you." Putnam soon decided to house it elsewhere alone. Of all Hepburn's suitors, Ludlow Smith was the most persistent. He was also the most convenient, with the mobility to keep up with Kate's desires socially and otherwise. In addition to business interests that allowed him to work in New York, he had his own car in which he drove Kate to Fenwick for weekends. He had very little ego and enough self-confidence to let hers run wild. She was often petulant and always impatient, but nothing ever seemed to faze him. More than once he raised the subject of marriage, of leading a long, comfortable life together outside of Philadelphia. But she refused, surrendering only her virginity, one afternoon when they were alone in Jack Clark's apartment. She felt a kind of love for him. "What else could I call my gratitude for his constant devotion?" she asked me. "I think the Greeks call it philos," I said, "a deep affection without passion." Where she had felt lust but little respect toward Phelps Putnam, she found it was the exact opposite with Ludlow Smith. She knew she was using him, and the only thing that made her behavior acceptable in her mind was that he knew it as well. She never veiled her ambition. Eddie Knopf's production of The Big Pond went into rehearsal in New York with Kate understudying the lead, who was suddenly dismissed at the last minute. And there in the wing stood Kate, a fireball of self-confidence. Not 2 months in the theater and she was already a star. "Or at least I thought I was," she later reported. "I certainly acted as though I was." She was so carried away with her own pre-Broadway opening night performance at the Great Neck Theater on Long Island that she raced through the play, forgetting every lesson Frances Robinson Duff had taught her. The next day, she was fired. Although fished out of The Big Pond, she had made a splash. Two prominent Broadway producers made offers to her that week. One came from J.J. Schubert, who suggested a 5-year contract at very good pay. She refused, not wishing to commit herself for that long a period, and having to appear in plays she might not like. The other came from Arthur Hopkins, who had been associated with several prestigious productions and who wanted Kate to play a supporting role in a modest play he was opening. She accepted, and the play closed after 3 performances. But Hoppy, as she called him, wanted her to learn lines immediately for another play that was about to premiere, Philip Barry's Holiday. He wanted Miss Hepburn to understudy the lead, Miss Hope Williams. While Kate's career was not advancing as rapidly as she had egotistically imagined, she liked Hoppy and she liked the play. She agreed to take the part and figured she would simply hope against hope. "Isn't it awful?" she said. "I used to pray for her to get sick." Just 2 weeks into the run, Kate herself got sick, of waiting. In a fit of impatience, she accepted Luddy's proposal of marriage. While wedding so solid a citizen as Ludlow Smith was as much as any parent could wish for a daughter in the late 20s, Dr. and Mrs. Hepburn were shocked at the conventionality of it all. For them, their eldest daughter's impulsive marriage was an act of rebellion, a way for her to assert herself without having to rely on them any longer. All they knew was that Kate was still attempting to figure out who she was and who she intended to become. It was a trying time for Kate. "I felt I was just stepping out on a high wire," she later admitted. "Luddy was my safety net." She told Arthur Hopkins that she was withdrawing from Holiday, and on December 12, 1928, Katherine Hepburn married Ludlow Ogden Smith in her parents' house at 201 Bloomfield Avenue in West Hartford. Her paternal grandfather, the Reverend Sewell Snowden Hepburn, presided before their collective families. After a short honeymoon in Bermuda, the newlyweds returned to Philadelphia to find a house where they could settle down. Thus, after only 6 months in show business, Mrs. Ludlow Smith rang down the curtain on her career. Chapter 4. Morning Glory. "Take off your pants," Katherine Hepburn barked at me as I stood in the entry hall at Fenwick. It was an early Sunday afternoon in April 1983, cold, windy, and rainy, and I had to return to New York City for a dinner engagement with a woman who over the preceding years had become one of my closest friends, Irene Mayer Selznick. Only a few hours earlier, Kate's brother Bob had arrived from Hartford with his wife Sue, and in the few seconds it had taken them to get from their car to the front door, they had gotten drenched. While I had been enjoying myself with the charming doctor, the sweetest man alive, Kate often gushed, an angel, and his well-read wife, I announced that I had to hit the road. After unsuccessfully arguing how idiotic it was for me to make the trip under such conditions, Kate said I should at least have the brains to take off my pants, then dash to the end of the driveway, where my car was parked, and move the car to the garage, which I could then re-enter through the house after I had put on the pair of trousers that had been kept dry. "I don't think that's necessary," I said. "I'll run with a large umbrella." "But your pants," Kate pointed out. "With the wind, they'll get soaked." I assured her that my plan was satisfactory. "Besides," I said, "I'm waterproof." "You may be," she snorted, "but your pants aren't." Of course, in the moment when I sprinted from the door to the car, the rain came down in sheets, and I could hear Kate howling with laughter. She met me at the back door to the garage with towels and said, "Now you've got to take off your pants, because you can't drive for 2 hours in them." I sheepishly explained that this was the only pair of pants I'd brought up for the weekend. Kate kindly said that would be no problem. She sent Phyllis on a mission to find a dry pair. "Go to Dick," she said, "or go to my closet, and if you can't find anything there, bring him one of your dresses." "I'm not driving to New York wearing one of Phyllis's dresses," I said. "Oh, you might have to," she said, delighting herself, "and there's nothing wrong with that. Phyllis has some lovely things, don't you, dear?" "Oh, yes," said Phyllis, perfectly oblivious to the fact that Kate was now pulling our legs. "But I don't think he'd fit into any of my things. Too tall." "Phyllis," I begged, "would you please try to find me a pair of pants?" "You know," Kate began to reminisce, "the first time Spence came up here, we had exactly the same situation, and he made a run for his car."
"And?" I asked.
"And I don't think he had to put on a dress." Phyllis returned with a pair of faded yellow sweatpants that belonged to Dick, far more conservative than anything I imagined Dick owning, which I gratefully accepted. As I started to go upstairs to change, Kate said, "Oh, Christ, just take off your pants right here." Before I could even protest, she assured me, "Dad used to walk around the house without any clothes at all." "But he was your fa—" I started to sputter when I realized that was even worse. "When in Rome," I figured. And so I turned my back to my hostess and changed pants. "And you should probably change your shirt," she added. I didn't even argue, pulling a dry one from my bag. "Now," she said with a big smile, "you're ready to go. Dinner tomorrow, drinks at 6. She leaned over for a hug and my hearty thanks for the weekend. While I was saying goodbye to Phyllis and Bob and Sue, she called out for Dick, who descended from upstairs wearing a pair of long underwear and a red nightcap. His ethereal friend Virginia Harrington followed. "The horn," Kate said. "Don't forget to honk the horn on your car. After you've left the driveway and you can see the front of the house, 2 times long, 3 short. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. Have you got that? 1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
"I've got it, but why?"
"Because that's what we do here," she replied, as though I had asked the stupidest question in the world. Then she explained it was a ritual for coming and going, a code that she and Howard had devised years earlier. I said my farewells and drove off, and as I turned left out of the driveway, I beeped the old 1, 2, 1, 2, 3 and looked to the front of the house. Through the rain, I saw them all standing in the doorway, waving goodbye, Kate's hands reaching out wide, reminding me of the last shot of her in summertime. The drive into the city took longer than usual because of the weather, but I used the time to replay in my mind the many scenes from the weekend, moments that seemed to come right out of You Can't Take It With You, hay fever, and on occasion Long Day's Journey into Night. I returned my rental car and went to the Upper West Side brownstone of my former editor Thomas Congdon and his wife Connie, friends who had become a second family to me. Tom handed me a batch of phone messages, Myrna Loy, Sylvia Sidney, Joan Bennett, all of whom were consenting to interviews about Goldwyn, and a Mrs. Lieberson, he said. "You're slipping," he added. "I haven't heard of her." "No," I said, "but she'd interest you the most, because you love ballet, and Mrs. Lieberson is none other than Vera Zorina, the former star of the New York City Ballet and a former wife of George Balanchine. And not only that," I said, "Sam Goldwyn was madly in love with her." Connie was more interested in my pants. "Where did you get those?" she asked. "Don't ask. I'll tell you later." I showered and changed and ran off to dinner,
And don't wait up, I suggested, because I know I'll be late. I took a cab to the Hotel Pierre on Fifth Avenue at 61st Street. The elevator operator brought me to the 10th floor, and at exactly 7, I walked to the door at the end of the corridor on the left, apartment 1007-10, and rang the doorbell. Although nobody embodied as much Hollywood history as she, Irene Mayer Selznick was not too grand to answer her own door. The daughter of legendary film mogul Louis B. Mayer, the former junk dealer who soon parlayed his New England distributorship of films into Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, the mightiest film studio in history, and the wife of David O. Selznick, the son of one of Mayer's arch-rivals in the early movie business, a young studio mogul himself who quickly became the most celebrated producer of his day, forever remembered for Gone with the Wind, was a longtime resident of the hotel. Some years earlier, she had bought up several suites and combined them into one luxurious apartment overlooking Central Park. I don't think she was more than 5 feet tall, with short, dark hair and bangs and the shrewdest pair of eyes I have ever seen. I know she was one of the most powerful presences I have ever beheld. As if her lineage were not impressive enough, upon divorcing Selznick, Irene moved to New York and hung out her shingle as a theatrical producer. Her first effort was the landmark production of A Streetcar Named Desire, for which she harnessed the talents of Tennessee Williams, Ilya Kazan, and a young Marlon Brando. She subsequently produced such hits as The Chalk Garden and Bell, Book, and Candle. It would be less than precise to call Mrs. Selznick an extremely difficult person, but she was easily the most challenging I have ever met. One never let down one's guard with Irene, unless looking to be knocked out or thrown out. Emotional, volatile, and analytical, she took nothing at face value, probing layers beneath layers in even the simplest matters. I had by this evening known Irene Mayer Selznick for about 5 years. At the start of my research on Goldwyn, Sam Goldwyn Jr. had said the most perceptive person I could possibly speak to about his father would be Irene Selznick, and he added she probably wouldn't speak to me. So warned, I didn't approach her until I'd been researching for more than a year and could ask questions in an informed manner. Then I sent her a letter outlining my goals and included a copy of Max Perkins. A second letter announced that I would be coming to New York in the near future, and if she could spare a few minutes, it would be helpful to meet her. Several weeks passed before she called me in Los Angeles one night after 10. She was working on her memoirs, she said, and she had a few technical questions about the merger in 1924 of the Metro and Goldwyn companies. Could I possibly straighten out some of the dates for her and direct her to any documentation? We talked for more than an hour, and on the next day I sent by overnight mail Xeroxes of a few relevant documents, providing answers I believed she already knew. The following night at 11, she telephoned again, inviting me to call upon her the next time I was in New York. Many long calls over the next few months ensued, during which time she'd been diagnosed with cancer of the nose. Before I arrived in New York, I heard from a mutual acquaintance that Mrs. Selznick was seeing nobody, having just undergone an operation in which half her nose was removed, as was some skin from her forehead to fashion a new one. I called her anyway to wish her well, and she apologized for her inability to receive visitors. 5 minutes later, she called back to say she had not seen anybody in ages, and as I didn't know what she'd looked like previously, I would not be shocked by any disfigurement. She clearly wanted company, and I seemed the perfect visitor, a friendly stranger. Could I see her after dinner that night? I packed a notepad in my jacket breast pocket. Upon arriving at her apartment, she ushered me into a small library where the lights had been turned down. I could still see fine, raw red marks between her eyebrows and down the bridge of her nose. She asked me how I was getting along with the Goldwyn family, then slowly, and in a voice so low I had to strain to hear her, she spewed details of the feud between her father and Sam Goldwyn. I sat there spellbound, too mesmerized to take notes. Once or twice I instinctively reached for my pen, but I hesitated before drawing it. A little after 1 in the morning I said, "Mrs. Selznick, I feel you should be getting some rest." She showed me to the door and said, "It's a good thing you didn't write anything down. If you come back for dinner tomorrow, I'll let you take that pad out of your pocket." Over the next decade, we spent countless hours together, in person when I was in New York, and on the telephone when I was in Los Angeles, usually after her city had gone to sleep. Her insights about Goldwyn and Hollywood and even the world were invaluable, but she came to exert an even greater influence on me,
leading me to dig constantly for deeper meanings. Her years undergoing professional analysis, to say nothing of her own insightful mind, and living with two of the most compulsive men in a community of severe personality disorders, had taught her to look for the truths that lay beneath all the falsities of Hollywood. Everything had a subtext, Irene believed, an inner truth more interesting than anything the naked eye could see. She was always more interested in that which was unspoken, in all that was not said. For her, little was ever stated directly. Every sentence was fraught with cryptic messages. As a result, conversations were like chess matches, in which Irene was always thinking two moves ahead. During one of our midnight phone conversations, for example, her second phone rang. She said she had to take the call and would call me back. When she did call, a little after 3 a.m. in New York, she started by saying, "No, your name didn't come up." I was immediately meant to deduce that she had only one friend who called her at that hour, William S. Paley, whom I had recently interviewed. Another time, when I was in the midst of writing, she asked how the book was going. As I prepared to describe the delicate stage I was at, she simply asked, "Fenestration?" I didn't quite grasp what she was saying, so I proceeded to explain how I had finished laying down the entire story and had gone through it a second time, stuffing in as many facts as possible, and that I was about to go through it again, this time taking things out, letting in air, opening up windows. "Ah," she said after my 2-minute description, "fenestration." In the middle of one extremely intense late-night conversation in apartment 1007, a siren outside sounded, and she saw my eyes move toward the window and hold there one beat too long. "Well," she said, "I just lost you. You were gone. We'll pick up this story next time." It took me 2 days to figure out what she meant when she described a beautiful chorus girl her father had been attracted to as a double gator, someone who swings both ways. She had a wicked laugh over which she would occasionally lose control, and nothing ever got past her. Her response to anything new, shocking or hard to believe, was, "You go to hell. Go right to hell." "So how did you get on with that brother?" Irene asked that wet Sunday night, not 4 hours after I had left Fenwick. We went into the cozy library, where we ritually sat for drinks. I went to the rear closet next to an exquisite picture of a little girl by Mary Cassatt, and fetched a canister of thin wheat crackers while she pulled from the refrigerator a crockery jar of herring and a chilled bottle. Carrie's Aquavit, she always called it, a rare brand her longtime friend Mr. Grant had introduced to Irene years earlier. Because it apparently could not be obtained outside Sweden, he always kept her stocked with a case of it. "Oh, the chemistry," she never failed to say, in response to the initial reaction in our mouths of the herring with the wheat and the aquavit. After a few gentle moans of ecstasy and a toast to Carrie, she said, "You never told me you knew my friend Kate." I explained that until a week prior, I had not known Katharine Hepburn, but that over the last few days a friendship had instantly unfolded. I also told Irene that I knew that people in her position were often approached by writers in their efforts to get to more famous people, and though I knew of the close relationship between the two women, I never wanted Irene to think for a minute that that was why I'd been spending so much time with her. She had, for example, recently befriended a man whom she unmasked as someone who really wanted to meet Kitty Carlisle, the widow of Moss Hart. Similarly, it had not been until my second day at Fenwick that I had told Kate of my friendship with Irene. This information had clearly prompted a call upon my departure, one that came after 50 years of ups and downs between them, a complex relationship in which each clearly admired the other, despite diametrically opposed approaches to life. After talking about Kate all through the dinner and into the early morning, I realized I was about to become a ping-pong ball in a game of two experts who played hard and fast. Toward 2, Irene got up from her chair, clasped my shoulder, rather melodramatically, I thought at first, and said, "You must go to her." I realized she was dead serious, and as always with Irene, obviously meant more than the literal. I'm sure I looked puzzled at her remark. "Kate has nobody," Irene said, with a touch of pity in her voice. "Nobody she can really talk to. She's spent so many years keeping people away, now nobody really comes around." I said that sounded a little extreme, that she seemed to have an active social life with people calling and knocking on her door all the time. "But nobody she can talk to," said Irene. "Certainly not that insane brother. Who's still alive who knew George Cukor?
Who knows who Grady Sutton is, Lowell Sherman, Dorothy Arzner? Everyone's either dead or doesn't know who they were when they were alive. In a low voice, she said that she loved Kate. Sister Kate, she signed her letters to Irene, referring to more than a popular song from their